Hello everyone and welcome back to episode 6 of Psyched to be with you with my very special guest and colleague Daniel Walker. This episode we talk all things sort of sports and psychology, the overlap between the two, concussion, football, how to avoid spoilers and much, much more. It was a really good chat. I enjoyed it. I hope you will too. As ever, all the information you'll need around my special guest will be included in the description below. Please enjoy it. Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of Psyched to be with you. I am quite literally psyched. I'm very excited. It is a pleasure and a privilege as always to be with you. This episode we've got another very, very special guest, someone I'm proud to say is a colleague as well. I'll pass it over to you in a second, so please give a warm welcome to my very special guest. Please tell us who you are, what you do, and what you do when you're not doing that.
Hi, my name's Daniel Walker. So as you said, my colleague is with yours. So I'm a GTA in the psychology department at Edgehill University. So my PhD at the moment is on concussion and how that affects three broad outcomes. So I'm interested in how predominantly sport-related concussion can impact on mental health, cognition, and then how that can impact our quality of life afterwards. I'm forgetting what the question was now, Chris. What else was there?
What do you do when you're not doing that?
What do I do when I'm not doing that? So I'm quite keen on exercise. So I do quite a lot of running. Go to the gym quite a lot. I quite like hiking. So anywhere sort of, you know, out in the great outdoors, as it were. So I've done Snowdon once. I was planning on doing Scafell Pike. I think, was it about April of last year, but obviously with restrictions we weren't able to in the end. So we are planning that soon, and then hopefully Ben Nevis at some point as well in the near future.
So going for the some of the big peaks.
Yeah, some of the biggest peaks. I've also done the Yorkshire Three Peaks, not in one day as a lot of people do actually, but I've done them, you know, separately, which were quite good as well. But yeah, I think there's always a bit of a sense of achievement once you've done anything like that. I don't know if you've done anything like that before.
I haven't done any like big sort of like proper hikes or anything, but you know, I enjoy a good walk. I've you know, ran races. I don't want to say sporty because I'm not as sporty as you, but I, you know, try and look after myself. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, I think everyone's definitely going to walking over the last year or so.
Yeah, well, you're one of the few things you could do.
Yeah.
So I was going to say, I think, you know, we've spoken before, obviously, with colleagues about your research area is generally really quite interesting. Obviously, it links to mental health, which, you know, if you've been with us before on the show, you know, we're very keen on. But generally, let's just talk a bit more about, like, you're midway through your PhD, you're on your final year, am I correct?
Yeah. So two years of the, hopefully three now. Yeah. So just starting my third year. So, So what was it you was asking? Just
well, I was just saying, so yeah, you're in your third year. Tell us about sort of like your research journey and sort of like, you know, concussion, mental health. That's quite a broad spectrum.
Yeah. So yeah, going back to undergrad, really, that's where it all started. My interest was predominantly back then was on that mental health, like you say. So. I think more in the media at that time, so this was probably about 5 years ago now, and it just kept coming out in the media with different sort of elite athletes that are struggling with the mental health and stuff like that, usually after retirement. So quite a lot of footballers that were reportedly sort of having depressive episodes and stuff like that. So I was quite interested in that just because I was interested in sort of depression anyway, just like sort of what is it? What, you know, how can we get it? How can we alleviate these symptoms, stuff like that? So I was quite interested just in general about mental health. But then I was also interested in how these sort of elite athletes, you know, they're very well paid, you know, they've got a lot of positiveness, positive energy in their life. So I was really interested in how these types of people can sort of suffer from depression. So Obviously, as an undergrad, I weren't able, well, I didn't have much access to like elite level players. So it did go on to a sort of student athlete. And as I was going through sort of like the literature, you know, sort of developing my ideas and stuff, one of the things that kept cropping up was concussion and how this could sort of exacerbate depressive symptoms. So that's really where the concussion sort of journey, as you coined it, came from. And then that followed into my master's, carried on with that there. And then pretty much that is how I've got onto these three broad outcomes, which obviously tail off into different directions of how concussion can impact those three bigger outcomes.
So what out of interest, what did you actually study? What were your undergraduate and master's degrees in? Because obviously there's a big, you're at, again, big spectrum of like sports psychology and biological psychology.
My undergrad degree was at Edgehill as well. That was sport and exercise psychology. So that kind of, well, sort of pushed me in that direction as well, because by the time you got to your third year, it was a requirement to do a dissertation in sport and exercise psychology. So doing something, I kind of mixed them together a little bit in terms of it was probably a bit more straight sight than some of the others in terms of I used a sporting sample, but whereas like some of my other like friends at the time were doing it, you know, a lot more sports psych, sort of like performance sort of based stuff. So I did that, and then funnily enough, I did kind of drift. I tried to pull myself away from the sports psych, and I did a master's, I did an MRes in Bath just in straight psychology. And then again, just because of my research interests, I just got sort of sucked into that, so still into, you know, concussion in sport and what that could lead to. I did decide during my dissertation in my first undergrad degree, that I enjoyed that much that I did want to become a lecturer. I did want a career in academia, just because I thought, well, I really enjoy this, and I really enjoy, you know, the research aspect, and I would like to make a career on that. And I've since realised that I do actually quite enjoy teaching as well, as I've been doing in my GTA role. So, during my master's, obviously, like that was when I got into applying for this GTA role, and luckily I got it. I did it. Must have done a good proposal and a good interview. So, and that has led on to like the last couple of years that I've been researching this now.
Okay, so that's great. We've got a really good sort of picture of like where you started from and where you've sort of got to. So you're heading into year three. Where are you up to now? Like, what's currently going on?
So far, I think I've written up three papers now out of what I've been doing from the data collection. So
for listeners' benefit, that's pretty good. Just pointing that out.
I hope so. Anyway. they're all under review as well at the moment, so hopefully some positive news back soon. Essentially what I've found at the moment is that with what surprisingly in the literature in concussion, because it is still quite new, despite the higher amount of sort of coverage it's getting at the moment, the research on concussion, even 10 years ago, it seemed to be like more of an add-on to what a different study was looking at. So as I say, in terms of like if someone was investigating depressive symptoms in athletes, it was always kind of a have you had concussion or not, that was just like an add-on at the end. So what a lot of papers haven't accounted for is pain, physical pain. Which is unsurprisingly accompanies concussion quite a lot, and just athletes in general, even without concussion. So what I've been looking at during my PhD is how this, you know, relationship between concussion and pain coincides, and sort of how they both relate to the three broad outcomes that I'd mentioned, really. So yeah, so the couple of papers that I found at the moment is that pain might actually be a bigger indicator of the mental health outcomes. So yeah, the physical pain is pretty much what could lead to higher depressive symptoms and higher state anxiety symptoms, and actually poorer quality of life. Whereas it might be the concussion itself that actually leads to poorer cognition, so poorer working memory, poorer cognitive flexibility, things like that. Whereas previous literature suggested that concussion leads to all three. So what I'm posing is that pain actually might be a bigger predictor of poorer mental health, whereas concussion is what causes poorer cognition, impaired cognition.
Okay, I mean, that's, again, like, that's really interesting and, like, needed work. I know you touched on it yourself. There's been a little bit of coverage around this. My only knowledge of it, like, personally, is from, believe it or not, another podcast episode that was looking at concussion in NFL players and, like, the detrimental effect that it had on them, like, you know, particularly around even some, like, very serious mental health conditions and physical damage to the brain and stuff. So it's definitely a under-researched area, you know, clearly because you're doing it as a PhD.
Yeah, definitely.
I hate to ask, I know it's a dirty question when you're studying your PhD, but what do you want to do next afterwards?
Yeah, so what, in terms of research? Cause,
anything, like, where do you want to go with the PhD?
Yeah, so at the moment, like, because I'm finding quite good findings with pain, significant findings with pain.
Well, just so again, for listeners' benefit, there, you know, significant is a scientific word, and that means a thing with measurements, and good and meaningful, maybe is a good one.
Meaningful is a good word to use, actually. Yeah, so because we're finding more meaningful results with pain. The issue that I've had is the measurements that we're using for pain. So where they're quite well validated measures for, like, depression and anxiety and stuff like that, with pain that there are quite so the one I'm using, for example, is called the NRS, and that's just a simple 0 to 10 scale of how much pain you've experienced in the past week. So that has its drawbacks. So as I say, because pain seems to be rearing its head during my research, I've kind of thought, well, you know, maybe should be attempting to develop a more rigorous pain scale. So that's what I'm doing at the moment, and hopefully I think that is what I could be doing in the years to come. So one of the things I'm trying to sort of, one of the gaps I'm trying to bridge is that to the different time points in which pain can be experienced. So as I say, the one that I've been using at the minute is experienced in the past week, which is important, but what tends to happen is people will then give an average. So if, for example, today, if I was to ask you, on Saturday you might have been in like a 10 and today you're in none, and then you might put a 5. And then it's not really grasping the true pain that you're in. And it's certainly not grasping the pain that you're in now. So what I'm posing to do is do two different time points, whereby you do what you're in right now, what pain you've got experiencing right now, and what you've done in the last week. So then you might put 0 now, and you might put, you know, 9 or 10 in the past week. And then that way we might be able to measure pain a little bit better. And the other thing I'm trying to do as well is identify the area of pain. So I've sort of divided the scale into different areas of the body. In that case, it could reveal sort of which areas of bodily pain or headache or whatever might predict poorer mental health or quality of life or cognition, for example.
I think that location one's really important because, I mean, you know, like, I've got, like, say, like, a really busted knee. Like, sometimes I maybe just get aggravation from that. But that can be completely dwarfed by the pain I feel from my existential dread. You know, two very different things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I've not included that one, but yeah, I know where you're going with it. So hopefully I think that's definitely got legs. Like, I think it's definitely something that'll be included in the PhD project and the thesis at the moment. But I also think it could be something that I could be doing for like a few years to go. Yeah.
You kind of mentioned before you found that you've enjoyed the teaching element of your role, so you're researching, you're teaching. Do you see yourself continuing that, or do you sort of see yourself more going into the hard research kind of stuff?
No, I do hope so, yeah. I think for me, I'd never had any teaching experience beforehand, and I was quite nervous. I think most people are, especially GTAs. I think when I did start, and remember when I did start, this was in person, this was January 2020, so when I started teaching, that is. So for about 8 weeks, it was in person in the pre-COVID world. And I really did enjoy it. So, you know, more so than I thought. And I think what I still remember now is that sort of other GTAs like around me sort of used to think it would refer to it as like a burden, like, oh, I've got teaching today, I'm doing this and that, and they'd really like, be wanting to do the research. But for me, it's always been like quite a nice, I wouldn't like to say rest, but I think it compartmentalizes what you're doing a bit better, I think, in terms of like, I think for me, if you get too sort of bogged down in research all the time, you could be less productive for it, I think. Whereas when you're teaching, it's kind of like, well, I'm doing this now, this is a nice break, like you get to socialise, like you get to chat with all the students, got some good ideas. And then once you've done that, you're like, okay, put that away now, and then back to the research. So I'm hoping to, yeah, I hope, obviously going into lecturing and stuff, I can carry on with, obviously lectures, but hopefully seminars as well.
Okay, well, that's pretty good. I mean, as I say, if you'll pardon the pun, it sounds like you've got your head screwed on. You know, you kind of know what you want to do and where you're going with it, and the research sounds really interesting. So what do you like to get up to when you aren't working? You know, what have you been getting up to lately?
At the moment, I've just been spending a lot of time with family and friends, to be honest. I think most people have been as well, like, obviously, what's going on and still going on. With the restrictions being lifted and stuff, it's been definitely trying to make up for lost time and stuff. I like to travel, so I've been to Edinburgh last weekend or the weekend before with my partner. Where else have we been? We've been to Cornwall over summer as well. We go in London as well next weekend. I quite like travelling, and definitely prefer travelling abroad as well. But I think, interestingly enough, I've kind of appreciated our own country a bit more. I don't know if you've done any travelling around here, but definitely like the lakes and Peak District, and as I say, Edinburgh, I've never been before. Not a massive fan of London, but I'll always visit. I wouldn't like to live there, but I'll visit. But yeah, I've never been Cornwall either, so in memory anyway. And that was brilliant. That was that week that we had like a heat wave, so we couldn't have timed it better, really.
Oh, I mean, that was not a fun week for me personally, but
was it not? No,
no, bit too hot for me. So you went to
Edinburgh, of course.
You went to Edinburgh for the first time. What did you think of that? I went for the first time last year as well. I really enjoyed it. What did you get up to?
Yeah, I thought it was amazing. Yeah, and I can't remember why we said we went. I think there wasn't even a reason we went. I think it was just a long weekend away. But yeah, it was. I really liked the history. I thought it was really good. We did two like ghost kind of walks. One of them wasn't like a. Neither of them were ghost walks, really. In hindsight, they were both called ghost walks, but the first one was kind of like a spooky tales walk. Where we sort of went around the city and they were telling us all like the history and stuff about Birkenhead and stuff like that. And then another one was where you went down into the vaults. I don't know if you did that. Did you do that?
No, not personally.
No. So that was quite interesting as well. And I'm not one, as as a scientist, I've got quite a rational mind. I think I'm not one for like ghosts and spirits and stuff like that. But when I was down there, he was telling me to basically stand in a circle of stones. I didn't do it. I was too nervous to actually do it. And now thinking back, it was surely it is just a circle of stones. But the story had attached to it. I thought, no, I'm not risking that. No chance. What else did we do? Went to Loch Lomond, which was beautiful. Thought that was really nice. It's nearby, isn't it? Stirling Castle. So that was a really good trip as well. So, what I would say is like Edinburgh. I just thought it was small, but to say it was, you know, a capital city. Like I thought it was quite a small city. I fell in love with the history of it. I really liked learning about, you know, sort of what's gone on in the last sort of hundreds of years, basically.
I would like to clarify, this episode is not sponsored by Visit Scotland. However, I would also like to add that Edinburgh was very good and very fun.
It was, yeah. Did you find the history interesting as well?
Or? Yeah, I went with my partner as well. We hit up a few museums. We went to the Medical History Museum. That was really interesting. We actually went on a tour from there. It's like you say, it was a spooky, but not necessarily like a true ghost tour, if you will. It was just a very nice place to be. As you say, it is quite, I'm going to say small, but that means you can sort of get around everywhere quite easily.
Yeah.
What else? We went to a place called, and again, this is not an ad, but if you ever find yourself in Edinburgh, Camera Obscura, like a house.
Oh, we didn't go. Illusions. The Illusion, yeah. We were thinking of doing that. We never got around to it.
Fantastic. Imagine how much more fun you'd have if you could see.
Whereabouts was it? Do you remember?
I honestly can't remember. I remember, it was on a hill, but that's not very descriptive for Edinburgh.
Yeah, no. Not very. Be around all day looking for the hill. Well, we did do that actually. Went to, what's it called? The hill. The basically overlooks the city.
The seat. Is it?
No, that's a different one. No, it wasn't that big. No. Arthur's Seat is that other one, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
No, this one was just, it was just kind of just a bit out of the city. But basically, the guide from on the Saturday, he basically said that's where you get the postcard picture, basically. So we walked up, and sure enough, it was really nice. So, yeah, that was good as well.
Good stuff. Well, I mean, I think, you know, you are right. You kind of have to make the most of these opportunities while you can, and, you know, responsibly. But particularly when, because I think it's something that I found with doing the PhD, and I always like to remind people at this point, I'm doing, you know, my first year, but you're never not expected to be working on something, right? Like, unless you are truly sort of taking a day off. And I know a lot of people see education like, oh, you get the summer off, there's no one to teach. It's not quite like that, so you really kind of have to make the most of these moments.
I mean, that just summed it up. There are so many people that still think that, one, a student in terms of, you know, which is technically true, but seeing me as a student as, oh, well, he just has the summer off and then he goes back. No, that's not the case. And two, he's a teacher, so he has the summer off. And again, like, it's not the case. So... yeah, some think I'm a student, some think I'm a teacher, but what definitely is the case is that I don't have the summer off.
How do you kind of find managing both, like, roles? Because they're not quite juxtaposed, but they're very different.
Yeah, I think what is good in our department, I'm sure you'll probably agree, is that we're never sort of treated as students. Like we always have a seat at the table, so to speak. Like people have respect for us and treat us as equal. So I think that's good, because I think that would be quite difficult, and I'm sure it probably happens in other departments in the country where it's kind of like, oh well, you're just a PhD student, you know, this and that. So I think in our department it's been really easy, because, you know, there is quite a level playing field with that. So I never really feel as a student, to be honest. I just feel more that we work in the department and we're doing our research the same as everyone else. It's just that ours is a PhD, basically. But I feel like you asked me another question that I've not answered then.
No, well,
would you guide in that somewhere else?
No, I was just sort of curious to ask. I mean, obviously, like, I'm going to be doing that myself, but like for benefit of again, because there's the idea of being a teacher and a student is that can blow a lot of people's minds. It's very, as I almost juxtaposed, but not quite.
I do feel more of a staff member than a student. I can't really remember what it was like to begin with though, but like, we have had different starting points really though, because obviously my first day was in the office, my second day was in the office, and so forth, like, so for the first few months, whereas like, you pretty much done, what is it, like 8 months now or something like that, 9 months now.
Getting into it, yeah.
Yeah, and yet to be, like, have that, you know, sort of experience in the department, so yeah, it's a bit different, but as I say, I think you'll probably feel the same way. I think you'll think, well, I'm not really a student, not compared to, well, to put it this way, when you're teaching the first year students, you'll know that you're not a student.
It's just going to reinforce that I feel old.
No, honestly, I thought that, because when I'd have just turned 24, and the 18-year-olds in front of me made me feel like a dinosaur, honestly. I thought, oh my god, like they are 18, like they are definitely 18. Like, some of them come in and they were, you know, some of them still thought it was school, like, you know, they were really timid and quiet.
They're all there.
Like, some asked to go to the toilet and stuff like that. It was crazy. Like,
they're there with the TikToks and, thought, wow, and the Snapchats and asking to go to the toilet.
Yeah.
Oh, whippersnappers.
Yeah, yeah. Honestly, you will feel old. You will realise then, though, I'm definitely a staff member.
Yeah. Sorry, we did sort of swing back to work there, going back out of work. So you like, so you've travelled a bit. You mentioned at the top of the show you like stuff like hiking, sports. What sports are you into? What do you play? What do you watch?
I used to play football. That was what I was mad about. Yeah, everyone in the country is the same. I still watch that avidly. Like, I'm a City fan. Don't know if that. I don't think you'll be happy with that.
For the benefit of international listeners, which city?
Oh, Manchester City.
Yeah, that's not me being obnoxious. Just, you know, there are several football clubs that have City in the name.
That is true. If people couldn't tell by the accent, but yeah, I am a Manchester City fan. So I've been going since I could remember, and fell in love even before the takeover. This was.
So, a proper football fan.
Yeah,
hello.
I used to watch absolute dross every week, and then probably 12, yeah, about 12, yeah. So that was quite nice, and then the 10 years that has passed since has been more than nice,
paved with gold.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I'll watch every bit of football that's on telly, and I'll go to the City as much as I can. Like, I used to, I had a season ticket in years, but I gave that up when I went to the Uni of Bath to do my Masters. Obviously, it was just too far. Like, I couldn't come back and I couldn't afford to pay that much, continue paying that much as a student and not go. So I'm hoping to get one sort of next season or the one after, and then start going there more regularly. But yeah, I do go here and there now.
I have to ask, because again, I know it's a little bit of a dirty question for PhD students, but have you found that like your research area has coloured your view of the hobbies, like of football at all?
No, that's a great question. It's a great question. So it's one I get used to answering now. It's usually the question of you say a dirty question. You probably coded it really nicely compared to most people. Usually I get asked, like, you know, how can you be doing that and still enjoy football? How can you enjoy boxing? How can you enjoy rugby? And my answer is always the same. It's always, I have perfect analogy now that I use. And my research, I don't want to sort of rip up the rule book. I don't want to change any sport. They're gonna ruin the sports that everyone loves them for. My research is just to inform, and the analogy is that people eat fatty foods, they smoke, they drink alcohol. They know the risks of all those three things, but still, some people still engage in them. Some people don't because of what they know the outcome may be. That's an informed decision. My research just wants to inform people so they can make the decision. Do they want to play rugby? Do they want to box? Do they want to play football? Former professionals now, sort of like Steve Thompson, he's a ex-rugby player. He won the World Cup for England in 2003. He's got early onset dementia now. Doesn't remember winning the World Cup. Doesn't remember the game. And he says now that he wouldn't have played rugby, like he wouldn't have done it if he knew what was happening. So that's my point, is that the research is there to inform, and if people make the informed decision and are aware of the risks, then that's fine by me. I don't want to sort of change any rules. I don't want to ban heading. I think I agree with limiting heading in training. I agree with banning heading sort of under 12s. Because that's kind of like a safeguarding issue, really, with children. But I wouldn't sort of ban anything in rugby or in boxing and stuff like that. But this is one of the things as well, is that you see with rugby, you can see how it is well managed, and that the sport is remaining the same sport, but the provisions around it are really starting to increase and starting to get a lot better. And that is something football, no matter how reluctant it is in pretty much everything, especially when it comes to player safety, needs to take note and needs to follow suit, really needs to emulate that, because it's not going to change, basically. It's not going to change. And the answer, I don't think, is to ban heading or to ban X, Y, and Z. But I do think that the change needs to be protecting the players in other ways, the same way that rugby do and other sports do.
Yeah, because I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it only like last season, the season before, that concussion substitutes were a thing?
Yeah,
you know,
permanent ones, yeah. Permanent concussion substitutes, which can't work. In rugby, the temporary concussion substitutes, which do work, and that's the whole point. So, for the listeners, the difference being that the temporary one, as the name suggests, you come off, you get assessed, someone takes your place. So the team isn't disadvantaged. You're not in danger. If you're okay, really, that player comes back off and you go back on. If you're not okay, then okay, that other player who's been put on for you stays on. That's brilliant. That's all it is. That's as simple as it is. But for football, it's a permanent one. And what a permanent one does is, it's no different to a normal substitute. The only thing is that you get two extra ones to your regulated three ones. So, as I say, in practice, a permanent concussion substitute, coach on the sideline will be reluctant to bring you off for the test, because if you're coming off, you will be off then. So that causes issues then. Should we bring him off? Is he going to be okay? So we're not really progressed anything. That's just pretty much the same as if we'd had the normal substitute. If you come off, you're off then, so someone else goes back on. If you're then okay, you can't go back on. So what is the point of it? It's not a concussion substitute, it's just a substitute.
And don't you also have okay, to then not play again for 5 days in football?
Yeah, exactly. And so if you're okay, and then you can't play for another 5 days afterwards. So it's not fit for purpose at the moment. And I've sent emails to the FA with no reply, and I am trying my best to try and get. I've written a piece on it as well. I don't know if you've read it in Cycreds, and pretty much explaining that process and how I think it can change for the better.
We'll make sure a link to that is in the description to wherever you found this.
Brilliant, nice little drop in there. But no, yeah. So I think one of the things is, football definitely needs to change it from permanent to temporary, because, I mean, it was just ridiculous that it was just a, bit of a PR stunt, I would say, like, in terms of introducing it, because it doesn't do anything. It doesn't add any safety to the players. It adds confusion more than anything. And as I said, well, there's been cases already, like George Baldock at Sheffield United played on till half-time and got brought off. I think they said Diop at West Ham was the same. And if you're bringing them off at half-time when you've got time to assess them, they weren't okay 20 minutes ago when they banged that. So, so I think one of them is definitely changing to temporary. And then another one, I think, is limiting the number of substitutes as well. And that's not the number of substitutes you can make, but the number on the bench. So at the minute, it's seven, isn't it? So you have 11 in the starting 11, obviously, and then seven substitutes. And then of a squad of like 25, what's that been 18? So seven players aren't on the bench at all. They're just wherever, in the stands watching. There is no reason for that now. That needs to change, because one of the things that I was thinking was that, and as I'm saying, I'm thinking proactively, and football in general is a very reactive sport, which is an issue. But and I think this will become an issue in years to come, and then they'll react to it again. But we should just change it now. So as I was going on, if you've got seven subs, positions you choose for your substitutes may not work out. So, for example, if the goalkeeper goes off for whatever injury, and then you put your other goalkeeper on, and that goalkeeper gets a concussion, what do you do then? What happens then? Whereas most squads will have three goalkeepers. So what I suggest is that you should have the starting 11, and anyone in the squad should be an available substitute. And then in that case, then it, you know, tactically, you're not at a disadvantage if it's goalkeeper was just an example, but if it was like a right back, right mid, whatever, then you'd have the whole squad at your disposal to choose from, and then it would reduce the coaches or assistant coaches or whatever saying like, oh, should we keep him on? Should we do this? Or, well, we've not got enough on the bench, or we're going to have to change shape. But if you've got your whole squad next year, then it's like, well, actually, yeah, we'll bring him off and we've got him to put back on. So I think that's another way that we could hopefully protect players a bit better.
So to play advocate a little bit there, what was your view on the five substitutions rule? Because there was a big kickoff at the time saying that, well, it benefits bigger clubs more than your lesser, richer clubs. They've got more utility to bring on their better players. Wasn't there a case or two last season where clubs like didn't even have enough players to fill the bench because of injuries and COVID and things like that? How do you think that would go down with the Premier League teams, as it were?
Yeah, with five substitutes, obviously I understood their ideas with COVID and stuff. It was more to do with tiredness, wasn't it? Because they had such a weird like off season and stuff, and coming back and stuff like that. I'm not too bothered about that. I'm not on about increasing the number of substitutes. I'm on about increasing the number of available substitutes. So I think if it was up to me, I would probably keep it at three. I think three is enough. But what the amount you have to choose from, I think, should increase to as many as you've got. Because then, like you say, you've got any team will be able to put on three players on the bench. Like you say, if the COVID issues and injuries and stuff, sometimes teams can name like five or six out of the seven. If you can name the whole squad, that would always be over three on the bench, wouldn't it? So I think keeping it at three, I would say, or going back to three, that you can actually make, but and then unlimited temporary concussion substitute. And what I will say actually is when you usually speak about this, people then tend to say, oh, well, you know, what if players then tactically try and abuse the rules? And to that, I just think, well, let them. Like, it, you know, players will abuse the rules no matter what.
I mean,
the players
anyway.
Are very intelligent. That's what I mean. So it's going to happen anyway. So I think it's telling how many people are more concerned about the rules being broken than the welfare of the players.
Yeah, I'm quite the football fan myself. You know, I enjoy the football. I enjoy football video games as well, particularly in like that squad management kind of aspect. But just talking about the rules, I think a good one would be, and again, hot topic, but VAR, you know. And like I always like to reference, particularly with player safety in mind, the delaying of an offside flag. You know, and you always hear the commentator saying it, like, how long is it going to be before the flag doesn't go up and a player gets a horrific injury and that could have been prevented because, well, we have to run it through the system. Like, what's your view on that? And then we can talk about VAR more generally.
Well, that actually is in the piece that I wrote as well, is that it's frustrating to see. I'm going on a little tangent, but I will come back. It's frustrating to see how quickly and how concerned the game is with VAR. Like, with
How many handball rules did we have last season?
Well, this is what I mean. Yeah, bringing it in, changing all the laws of the game to suit it, changing it year on year since it's come in, and ignoring other aspects of the game like player safety, because they are just the puppets that play the game essentially in their eyes. So that's what does frustrate me. But VAR, I'm certainly not a fan of it. I really don't like it. I'm more of a fan of just keeping it as human as possible. Like, I know it was frustrating with referees and offsides that weren't, and you know, goal line technology. Actually, I don't mind. I'd keep that. So we failed once in like, what was it, 10,000 times. So I would keep that. But VAR and stuff is ruining the game. It's slowing it down. Like you say, for some reason, the linesmen are now told to keep your flag down until they potentially score, because then we can check it. But as you say, you're keeping the flag down and then they could potentially break the leg, or it could, you know, anything could happen. Where a lot of the time you just put your flag up and then we can check the offside instead, can't we? Yeah, for me, I would keep VAR if we just didn't obsess about it too much. And I'm concerned that it's more TV might have a bigger influence than what people might think in terms of making it a better spectacle for the watcher at home. But I'll tell you now, it's not a good spectacle when you're in the ground and you just stood there thinking what's going on. And when you can't celebrate goals the same anymore because they're checking every tiny little detail. I'm not sold on VAR, to be fair.
I hear one of the common sort of criticisms is that they should adopt a system similar to rugby, where you get to hear the refs talking about the check, you understand their thought process, they're talking to the players. And like it is that kind of, you let play happen, then you review it. And then, like, if a decision's wrong, they rectify it. It's much, they've got the rules much more ironed out. I'm not a huge rugby fan myself, so I don't know definitively.
No, they're good. And like I said, they're definitely on it more with concussion as well. But I was going to say as well, tennis could be a good sort of system that they use in the three challenge system. You know, if the manager wanted to challenge a decision, if you get it right, you keep your three. If you get it wrong, you're down to two. And you know, both teams get three challenges. If there was a close offside, is it worth the referee, you know, the coach saying, like, oh, we'll go to VAR now? And then VAR looks at it, you know, as I say, if it was right, you keep this challenge. And then, so it could be anything from, I don't know, like, it probably won't work with, like, red cards and stuff, would it? But anything that's, like, I suppose that with dangerous play, you would keep that to the ref and the ref go into the monitor and stuff. I think for offside, you could potentially bring in the challenge system. I think would be quite good.
They also use that in cricket, don't they? I believe you get like challenge.
Exactly. So,
because I think another one is like, you know, again, like, you know, I'm a Liverpool fan, and I've seen scenes of an armpit being offside, so a goal not being given, and the whole like. You don't really gain an advantage from my armpit being offside. And I remember one, Patrick Bamford was, played, went on, scored, but it was not given because he had his arm out telling his his teammate where he wanted the ball, which if you've played football ever, you understand it's a completely natural part of the game. Because, I mean, pointing is like, you can do more with that. Because if you shout, you're also telling all your opponents what you want doing as well.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's funny you mentioned that, because that was exactly the example I was going to use. Because if you actually watch it back, he's curving his run as well. So he's running back towards his own goal to get onside, to curve his run, basically. And then he's put his arm out to say where he's going. So when the ball's played, he's running back. But because in the freeze frame, there's that tiny little bit of his sleeve probably is offside. But my argument is that he's not gaining an advantage. He's running back towards his own player who's got the ball, curving his run to then go forward. So it's not even one of them where. So those ones really annoy me, because obviously if you're running and you've got the momentum and you're running forwards, then you are gaining an advantage. If you're running backwards and then you're offside, you're not gaining any advantage, because if you carry on the video like that, you know, then you could receive the ball 5 yards in front of the defender behind you. They say, oh, well, you're offside. Well, you've not gained anything, so just play on. And I think that is, it's important to keep the game sort of fluid, isn't it? But I'm worried that VAR is doing the exact opposite.
You touched on it yourself with the whole making it a spectacle. Like, the lines. I feel like we've got to talk about the lines. How the lines do just seem drawn on differently every single time by every different person.
Well, yeah, I think there was one, obviously, we won't get into an argument, but there was one where City are at Anfield, one of the drummings that you give us every year. And I'm sure the lines weren't even straight. Like, if you looked on if you compare it to the lines, you know, from the grounds on the pitch, the VAR one didn't even look straight. I was thinking, that's, you know, you're literally building a case for basically everyone saying that they're drawn on, because they just look different every week.
They really do. Like, and like, it's like they're always at a janky angle, and it's just like just the pitch. And I suppose it maybe goes. And we're just talking football meta now. I apologize, listeners, if you're not football fans, but like. Pitches can be different sizes within a certain parameters, right? So you couldn't even just say, well, all pitches are broken up into these grids, because that wouldn't work, because pitches are different sizes to within certain degrees, right? But I mean, why do we not just have a grid map of the pitch? I mean, like, okay, so we would know where the lines would be. Even something as simple as that would clear up all that level of confusion.
Yeah. I don't know. I would just... For me, I wouldn't even use it. I would use it, but not the lines at all. I would use VAR for offsides, you know, just completely blatant ones. Like, do you remember Sterling for Liverpool against City? Do you remember that time where you scored against us? It was about 5 yards off onside. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. Like, I would use VAR for that, where you quickly go to, you go to the monitor and goes, right, that's a clear and obvious error, which is what they keep telling us. And then using it for the complete opposite. But, errors that aren't clear and obvious. And then I would just keep the ones that are like fingernails and, you know, a tiny bit of the shoulder.
Armpits.
And just give the advantage to the striker. Like, yeah, just give... We want the game to have goals. Give the benefit to the striker. Carry on. And if you know, the referee, the VAR ref, spots something and says, oh, no, that's completely wrong, like, that is... You know, you need a quick look at this. Then we can change that one. And I think that's where technology in sport, or VAR, whatever you want to call it, could be the to the benefit of the game. But yeah, the making it a spectacle, as I said, with the lines and stuff, really, really frustrates me.
And
it frustrates me more being in the ground at the time.
To bring that back as well, you know, it's important for like that element of like player safety and stuff. It really is. Like, it's as simple as that.
Yeah.
You know, because how long will it be before something happens?
Well, it will happen, yeah. I remember there was a point where there was an absolute ridiculous, I can't remember what country it was in now, but there's a ridiculous, this is going away from PlayStation, but I'll come back to it, but where, like, there was something like, well, it's not his kind of player safety, but I think there was a challenge in the box, one end, and then it wasn't given as a penalty, but the player stayed down. And then that team went up and scored. And in the end, they had to chalk that goal off and give the penalty to the other team. So it's an absolute joke because, like we said, instead of, I know this wasn't the linesman, it wasn't offside, but instead of the referee hadn't seen something, but in any other, without VAR, that would have just been a goal to the other team. But because we've got VAR and because we're analysing everything so quickly now and so in detail, it makes a bit of a mockery of it because it's like, oh, well, we're taking that goal off, you know, and then we're giving these a penalty and I'm sending you off because it was dangerous play. And it's an absolute mess.
That needs to be happening before, doesn't it? Let it go that far.
You can't go up the other end and score a goal and then chalk it off, surely. But I think it is a matter of time, like you say, when the linesmen keep the flag down because they've been instructed to, and then someone just gets seriously hurt. But then it's even more a bitter pill to swallow when it was avoidable.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it just is. We spoke about football for a while here, but and it wasn't intentional. But we relate all this back to because this is important. I know they're thinking of shifting rules like stopping the clock when the ball goes out of play and things like that. It's like, okay, you can see why they're trying to do that, but that again just feels more like show pieces, and it's like, oh, we want the game to be this way, but then we're instantly going to put things in that go against that. We want the game to flow, but we can also stop it after you've scored and decide it's not a goal for reasons.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. Like I say, the clear and obvious error, that's the thing we keep going on about when, and then they'll use it for everything that isn't clear and obvious. Another contradiction is the same thing, is the clear and obvious error, and then the referee will look at something for about 5 minutes. It's not clear and obvious if you have to look at it for 5 minutes. As you just say, what was it you just said? I've forgotten now.
they'll really start talking about moves we'll start stopping the clock when the ball goes out.
Oh, of course, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we want the game to flow was the other one. So we want the game to flow, and then they do the exact opposite and stop everything that you can at each given moment. So, yeah, frustrating is VAR, and frustrating is the amount of effort and resources put into it when other areas of the game get neglected.
Okay, so to just sort of take a little bit of a shift, what sort of other stuff do you get up to? We obviously big sport fan, it bleeds into your work a little bit. What else? What do you do when your mind is not thinking about sport?
I've tried to read as best I can, because obviously with the job that we're in, we're reading quite a lot on a monitor. So I think and obviously you're quite concentrated with that. So I do try to read as best I can, like an actual physical book. I try to do that as pretty much once a day or so.
I think, yeah, reading for pleasure is a more unique challenge when you're having to read for academic purposes.
Exactly.
Have you read anything good lately?
Yeah, I do find that it does bring me down a bit, though, to be fair. Because you're actually using your imagination a bit and you're thinking about something else. I read The Satirist of Auschwitz recently. I think that was an excellent book. I don't know if you've read that.
I haven't personally.
But you can imagine what it's about, given the title. It was semi-autobiographical. Well, it was biographical, because it was someone else who wrote about him. But, just telling the story of Tato by Tattooist at Auschwitz, and basically how he had to do what he could to survive, essentially, and what he was doing was tattooing his own people, basically, and he had to put the numbers on each person's arm, and as I say, that's not the whole story. It goes on to other bits and things, And yeah, basically, yeah, what he did to get through living there.
I've read anything else like less like it than I like soul destroying.
To be honest, I'm quite interested in the war, so I do read quite a bit on that. So no, the sequel actually, Silka's Journey, is what I'm reading at the moment.
I mean,
so
I will like put my hands up. I read a lot of sci-fi dystopia, which is like the end of the world kind of stuff. So I asked that question tongue in cheek. I mean, I was reading The Stand by Stephen King during 2020, which is about a plague that wipes out humanity. So you know.
I'm glad you're still here. I think what I was going to say was Silka was basically one of the people that was in Auschwitz with the tattooist of Auschwitz, so that's the second book that she's done based on her life as well. That one wasn't in Auschwitz, it's basically after Auschwitz, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's any lighter than the first one. I should probably get like a quite easygoing book next. I read 1984 last year as well. That's
a classic.
Pretty heavy going as well. Yeah. So
what did you think of 1984?
I really liked it, mate. I think I wouldn't mind reading Animal Farm as well, to be honest. But yeah, I think I really enjoyed it. Definitely made me think. And I was never aware that Big Brother, the television program, was based on that. But no, it was good. What did you think of it?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, I'll try and do it spoiler free, but like I remember physically getting chills when like there was the twist. Like in towards the third act, I remember being like, "Whoa!" like that, and like that's a really impressive feeling to get from, you know, like from a book that it takes very well crafted writing to do that in a non sort of, you know, particularly in a non like horror genre, you know, where you kind of maybe geared up for that more. It's so interesting to, you know, I read it a couple of years ago, and to see just how impactful it still is today and how meaningful it is, and you know, it's quite shocking. You know what I mean?
I was just going to say, I'm not 100% sure on when it was written. Probably getting up to about 80 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, I'm rereading Dune by Frank Herbert, which was like 75. And like so much of the commentary around like fossil fuels and resources and race and sexism is like still apparent, and it's kind of terrifying how like did have we learned nothing from these artists, from these authors?
This is it, isn't it? Those are the ones that stand the test of time, isn't it? When they're speaking about humanity and nothing changes. I suppose Lord of the Flies is pretty similar as well. If you read that, and it's like it's one thing to sort of. What's the word? It's one thing to write about how society is and predict how it could become, and then it's another thing for it, as I say, stand the test of time and for things perhaps not to change, or perhaps the predictions to go seemingly true.
It's really interesting, and as you say, one of my favourite, I think the thing I loved most about 1984 is really simple, but it was like the Ministry of Love, I think, like love and relationships, but it's like,
yeah.
Oh, all that is just—that's just pure spying. We just call it the Ministry of Love because it sounds better. Again, like, you know, spoiler free, but like the ending, because I can freely admit I hate like all stories have to have a happy ending. Like the good, quote unquote, because that's a philosophical term, and you know, perspective is important in good and evil, quote unquote. But like, you know, the good side always have to win and things have to be great, and I was like, like if you've experienced,
it's not realistic, is it?
If you've experienced real life, that's not always the way things roll out.
No. And I don't know, actually. Just careful what I have to say. No, I was going to say, I think children's books should probably not end in like, you know, tragedy, but perhaps we shouldn't be gearing them for success all the time and gearing them for a happy ending all the time. I don't know. It's definitely the way with children's books, isn't it, in terms of all the good guys win and the bad guys lose.
Well, there's a big criticism of like fairy tales in general, how like the sort of modern kind of, I'm going to say, Disney influenced, I guess, impacted, like are all geared like that, when the original kind of stories are much more, you know, they're a warning more than anything.
Yeah, that's true. The Disney, Walt Disney was not, was nothing like what it is now, is it? This wasn't his idea for Disney, really, was it?
No, I mean, the phrase I was looking for was a cautionary tale. Like, a lot of the original fairy tales are, this is why you don't wander off into the woods and meet strange women.
Yeah, more of a fable.
Yeah.
Essentially, it's got a deeper meaning of a lesson, a life lesson.
I think we're maybe going like too metaphilosophical here, and I apologize for that. But like, I think one of the trends I found with stuff that I've read that has been released more recently, is like it kind of bonks you over the head with its like message, right? Like, so, like, again, pardon the concussion pun, I apologize. But it really tries hard to be very explicit in like, this is the point I'm trying to make. And I think compared to, maybe it's unfair, you can completely call me out for that. But like, the thing that makes a thing art, in my opinion, is that it allows you to interpret it. Like, the artist may have a vision, but they give you it and then you walk away and you interpret it the way you want. And 1984 is a good example of that, how there are multiple interpretations.
And I think the reason that everyone always says, oh, the book's better than the film for pretty much everything. I'm yet to hear anyone say the film's better than the book. I think that's the reason, isn't it? I think books is up to you to interpret, even for something like you say is quite evident what the message is and you're still interpreting like what this character looks like or sounds like, or you know, the emotions they're feeling. And I think that's the difference, isn't it? When you watch a film, it's kind of someone else's interpretation they're forcing on you, but they've read the book, they interpreted it, and this is what they've come up with, and they're showing it to you. Obviously, the benefits of film is it's all quicker and all this lot, and, you know. But I think that is, it's the same point, isn't it? That's why people enjoy books, but we may be going too far the other way, even with film, in that everything has to be so explicit and so forced that rather than being a bit more subtle and giving you, allowing you that extra interpretation.
I mean, I actually have an example of a time when...
the film was bad.
Well, no, actually. No, I'm wrong. No. I was going to be like, I was going to say a film where like they wrote a book afterwards and the book was dross, but...
Oh, right. Which one was it?
I'm sure they like did something like that with like Star Wars, where like, they then like, you know, to monetize it, they just produced books.
They wrote books afterwards. Yeah, I'm not too sure on that.
But they're maybe not like full novels. It's not really a one-to-one comparison, is it? I'll be fair.
Nearly a good one though. Nearly a good.
Maybe one day it'll happen. Someone will turn a. I think. Okay, so again, slight tangent, but I feel like you see it more interesting with TV shows. So you know, Game of Thrones, for example.
I'm just about started that, so no spoilers on that for me, please.
No spoilers. I feel like I'm just naming brands. Like, you know, Netflix are famous for, you know, they do a season that's based on a book and then they want more, so they produce more and, you know, things like that. But like with Game of Thrones, it was very evident where they started to go off the material that wasn't like, not exactly one-to-one, but taken directly from the book. You could notice a distinct change, in my opinion, in quality. That's my opinion.
Had you read the books before yet?
Yes, yeah, I read the book up to like the point they are at the time of recording. You see, so for context, another good example is Netflix's You. It's based on a series of books.
I've seen that, yeah. It's good.
I forget the author's name. I'm reading the third one at the minute. Caroline something. I apologize. I will add it to the show notes. But like, I'm now reading the third one, and it's after there were significant changes made to the show in the second season compared to the book. And reading it, you can tell where that's had its influence, and you kind of got this almost symbiotic nature of the fact that the show is different to the second book, second season is different to the second book, and how the influence of the show has impacted the third book. So how is that going to affect the TV show? And it's like a you can really feel its influence.
You think?
I think it has. Yeah. Again, personal opinion.
Strange, isn't it? Really, because having started watching Game of Thrones, like I'm midway through season three now, and just the depth of it, I think is like I just think, well, these books are going to be incredible. Like surely, like you know, because the depth of it, but it's still at times quite shallow at the same time. So there's so much going on, and I just think, well, you know, in a book you can really explore these characters and all these different things that are going on. So immediately when I started watching it, I just thought, yeah, these books will be really, really good. But yeah, so it'll be interesting to see if his pan out that same way. If you know, the success of the season, of the series has had like an impact on these books that he's continuing to write.
And again, spoiler free, I have a question about that in a second. But I honestly think because of fan reaction to the show, I would not be surprised if George R. R. Martin changed it and was just like, this was the ending all along.
Well, I mean, I was having this conversation as well with my brother the other day, and I thought, surely he'll change it anyway, just for monetary purposes. Like, when nobody knows the ending again, the second time round, and as you say, it almost feels ridiculous for him to go along with an ending that people weren't happy with. To, you know, the self-fulfilling prophecy of disappointment. It's just, I can't imagine him doing that, to be honest. And then once the new book is out, they'll make another series on the righted ending.
Yeah, I mean, you can see it happening. But I have to kind of ask, you know, you're watching it for the first time. How have you managed? Have you avoided spoilers? Like, do you have no idea what happened?
So
my question is, how did you avoid the spoilers?
Really well, because to be honest, whenever people spoke about it around me, and you can appreciate this with the names. Like, I'll have heard names in the past that I know now, but I never knew them then. So the very obscure names that I would just never have popped onto, I'd never, you know, thought of, with the exception of a few, obviously. But and even because of the context of it, like, even if they'd said something, I wouldn't have understood it or remembered it anyway. And then I think because of my interest in it wasn't there, people never really said anything to me or anything. But I am having to keep it a secret now that I am watching it, because I know people will attempt to spoil it for me just because everyone's seen it. But the only thing that has annoyed me now, actually, is when I was watching Gogglebox about a year ago, and it was on that. There's a bit of it on that, a bit of the last episode. And I will tell you, it's basically Daenerys riding a dragon, and that is pretty much all I know. But it's a spoiler enough that I know she gets to the end, essentially.
I mean, in a show and a story where people like drop like flies, that is still quite spoilery.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah, exactly. I can't change that now. But as far as they go, I'm pretty happy that I don't know anything else.
As I say, that's an impressive feat, to be honest.
To have gone through. I think the thing with spoilers, though, is usually it's around the time of when they come out, isn't it? Like, and then it all just died out. Like, people aren't just, like, tweeting now about Game of Thrones saying, like, this happens and the other. So, like, when it... I don't know how I'd do it, because I did it with Line of Duty recently as well. Watch that.
I have not. And it's like, on the very, very long wish list of things to watch.
Yeah, brilliant. You should watch it. I regretted that I didn't watch it as it came out. I was... When this sixth season came out, I thought, I'll just watch him, and yeah, it's brilliant. But during that, so I started watching it like from the beginning when this last season started. So every Sunday night, I'd just avoid Twitter because I knew everyone was just going about it. So I think maybe that's my technique. I used to just avoid Twitter when something's on.
You heard it here first, peeps. If you want to avoid spoilers, just avoid the internet.
There you go. get off the internet, just read a book.
Read a book. Fair enough. Okay, so just to sort of go back to the sort of questions a little bit, we've spoken a little bit about what you want to do next with your work. This is one of my favourite questions to ask. What would be your blue sky project? So there are no limitations. You have infinite resources, time, a team of people that are expert in every single thing you need doing. What would that project look like?
Wow. That's quite a hard one to answer that. I know that it would definitely still be on what I'm doing now. Like, it would definitely still be something to do with concussion. It would definitely have to be more with sort of the older generation now than I guess maybe working with you keep seeing now like sort of those that are in the 70s and 80s that used to play football that are getting dementia now. I guess that I'd love to do a project with like sort of those people, whether that was like qualitative or quantitative. And as well, working with the families of them as well, I think, is understated. Is, you know, they are people in the end, like that, and they are leaving people behind. So Dawn Astle, like daughter of Jeff Astle, who died nearly 20 years ago now, and she's campaigned ever since and stuff. So I think, yeah, working with the families of them would be quite a good project, and as well as obviously that older generation as well, because it is a bit of a harder demographic to get hold of. And you know, you know what it's like. You usually, the vast majority of research is university students, isn't it? Just because of the ease of obtaining them. But yeah, I think it would be quite beneficial if we were to get hold of this older generation now, that where there seems to be a link with dementia and heading the ball, if we were then able to better understand what you know, every generation below them might be looking towards in the future.
Fair enough. And I think, again, you know, for listeners' benefit, that is the kind of project that is, that's a blue sky idea, because that would be really difficult to do in terms of time and resource. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah. I think I think the want for the players would probably be there, but again, yeah, I think the capacity for different players would be different, wouldn't it? Depending on if they had dementia or not.
And I think level. So I've got another question, and this is one that I admittedly came up with very recently, so it wasn't on the sheet I sent you, I apologise. But have you got, you know, I like to, you know, this is about me speaking to people and you know, people's real stories, if you will. So apologies if this is a very left field question, but like, have you got anyone or anything that particularly inspires you to do the work you do? Like, you know, is there anyone like maybe who's like work you really like look up to and you go, yeah, they're doing what I want to be doing? Or even just like, you know, it can be like an important figure in your life. You're just like, yeah, like these people help inspire me, carry on doing what I'm doing. Like, you don't have to be like, oh, I love like this author, or like, you know, you could just be like me mum because she's class, you know, like that's, but like, is there anyone that maybe gives you that inspiration maybe?
I think, I was having a similar conversation actually with someone in the sport department who's also a GTA, and we both sort of agreed on the same answer in terms of it's important to have this kind of inspiration, and I'll veer off slightly I'll answer it, child. So basically, it's all about having inspiration from different areas, because inspiration or motivation can come and go depending on various things, and especially over a long period. So people, as I say, people might be there and they might not at different times, whether that is like, you know, you have got your parents that are predominantly there, you know, for large periods, or things like relationships can change, whether that's romantic or platonic, like. And then, so to get to the answer, I think one of the things that is really important is to do it for yourself, is to inspire yourself, essentially. Because if you don't, if you're not doing it for you, if you're doing it for other people, then in the end, I think it would be really difficult for you to continue or for it to be sustainable, essentially. So I think I was really trying not to make it a selfish answer, but I think I inspire myself to be better all the time, basically. I want to be better than I was yesterday and then just carry on and on and on. But obviously, it goes without saying, like, the, you know, family and friends is hugely important. Like, you've got to have that as well. But yeah, to veer off again, what I was getting at was that it's not always people, so... sometimes your motivations can come from other things, but it can't just be one sole thing, because if that then disappears, then what have you got? Like, what motivates you? And I think that would be probably from a third year PhD student to a first year one, that would be a piece of advice in terms of maybe recognizing what it is that inspires you, because then you'd probably be better equipped to know if something sort of changes or if something drops, it's okay, or well, it's all right. That's all right, that's happening in the background, but I've still got all these reasons to be doing what I'm doing.
I mean, I'll be honest, that was a very candid and very nuanced answer, considering I plucked this question out like a couple of days before production.
Thank you.
So really, I mean, that's, you know, you heard it here first, like, in be your own inspiration. Like, obviously, other things are important, but if you're not inspiring yourself to push yourself forward and take through what you're doing, then that's a big barrier to entry.
Well, actually, I think full disclaimer. I think I've definitely been inspired by, I don't know if you'll have ever seen it, Matthew McConaughey, his speech at the Oscars, I think it was. Have you seen it? Have you seen the?
I don't know it off. Like, top of my head.
Offhand. Well, I saw it once, and I think that's what's resonated with me since. And it's pretty much a similar idea. So if any of the listeners want to watch it, or probably tag it in on YouTube as well. Even for yourself, you can watch it after this. But he was basically, someone asked him, like, who's your hero? Basically, that was it. Who's your hero? And he said, well, it's me. It's me in 10 years. And then, like, 10 years later, you know, someone came back to him and said, who's your hero? Are you your hero now? He says, well, no, I'm not. I'm not even close. Like, and then, like, 10 years again, are you your hero? I was like, no. And basically he was saying, like, he's never gonna get there. He's never going to attain it. But it always gives him something to chase, always something to keep him motivated. And then he obviously said, like, other different things. So, like, his family and stuff. But it was always about that, being better than he was, you know, in the past, and always looking to be, I'm my hero, it's myself, I'm the one who motivates myself, but I probably won't ever attain that, and that's good, because it'll keep me going and going and going, you know, forever.
Well, I mean, you know, that is an excellent answer. It's an excellent answer, and, you know, it'd be interesting for listeners to compare that with our other guests' answers.
Yeah, I think I'll have to listen back and see what other people say.
So let's get into a little bit of fun then. We like to sort of get into a bit of a laugh before we finish. Because I feel like we've kind of gone, you know, some very serious matters that's quite troubling, you know, a little bit of sport, and we've sort of come back around to, like, oh, you know, we're on, like, a little bit of a crest of a wave. Hello everyone, and welcome back to episode 6 of Psyched to Be With You with my very special guest and colleague Daniel Walker. This episode we talk all things sort of sports and psychology, the overlap between the two, concussion, football, how to avoid spoilers, and much more. It was a really good chat. I enjoyed it. I hope you will too. As ever, all the information you'll need around my special guest will be included in the description below. Please enjoy it. Here, so let's just end with our quick fire questions. So you are taking a sabbatical, a retreat. You're not being sent away. You're choosing to go away to a little resort for a little while. The only problem is you're going very quickly, so you can only grab one of the following items each. You're allowed to take one. Originally it was one film, but I've been quite lenient. I've let people say one DVD set. One,
you know, all right, okay.
So your TV shows are included. An album, a book, and then like a video game or other entertainment item, as you might find applicable. What do you take?
Is it one of each? One out of all of those. One of each. Okay. So I think the film would be Inception. I love that film. And as you can tell, I'm quite a thinker. If you've not gathered that over the last hour or so.
Someone studying a PhD, a thinker, colour me impressed.
Yeah. Yeah, spoiler alert. I think Inception's brilliant. So I think I find something else out like I've never thought of each time I watch that. As a true Mancunian, I'd say What's the Story, Morning Glory by Oasis. I think that's, you know, can't go wrong with that. Superb album. Book, just because I enjoyed it so much, I think The Tattooist of Auschwitz. This is going to be quite a dreary retreat, isn't it, for me? And then, what was the other one?
It's previously been down as a video game, but if you're not like a video game, it's just like something else that you do to entertain yourself.
Okay. It's a video game thing. And I fell out of video games, really, to be honest. But the one game that just got me hooked, like when the only one that I spent hours and hours, days on was Fallout 3. I think that was just superb. Brilliant game.
That's a good shout. And then last but certainly not least, do you have any questions for me before we wrap up?
Where do you see yourself 2 years from now? So in my position, starting your third year.
Oh, I mean, stressed. Is that a?
I hope not.
That's a great question. I don't know. I mean, you know, I've got my Gantt chart, and if I stick to it, nearly done. You know, that happens or not. Oh, who knows? But you know, hopefully, like, you know.
Make a new one like everyone else does.
Well, you know, I always describe myself, particularly on this show, as someone who wants the cake and wants to eat it too. So I want to be, you know, on the back of conferences, having presented about like my first study that I've done, you know, sort of first like data collection and stuff. And I want to be like wrestling to try and get papers out and disseminate that information to anyone and everyone, and getting ready to write up the whole thing and get myself those nice three letters at the end of my name to match the rest of them, you know.
Yeah, well, I think from what I've seen, I don't see why not. I think you're doing really well at the minute.
Thank you very much, I appreciate that. For the benefit of listeners, obviously the information will be attached below, but where are people best to find you online? We've got your Twitter up there, but where else would be good?
Yeah, there's on Twitter. I'm not massively on other different platforms, but my email address, do you want me to recite it or do you want to just attach it?
I can attach it, as long as people know sort of where it is.
Yeah, Twitter or my uni email address are the two best places to find me.
Awesome stuff. Right, well, thank you, Danny, for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. I hope you had a good time. All that remains for us now is to say goodbye to our listeners. So I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Psyched to be with you. I'm enjoying this as an entire experience. This has been a chat that's been a little bit different to all the others. The most sporty, which I quite like. I'll talk about football any day of the week. So we'll move over to the ending screen for the video edit. So thanks very much for watching, everyone. And we'll see you again very, very soon. Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Psyched to be with you. I really hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. As ever, if you did enjoy it, please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really, really helps. If you want to keep up with all things Blind Psyche, check out the episode description for a link, or you can go direct to linktr.ee/blindpsyche. Thank you so much for listening. As ever, look after your mind, body, and soul, and I will see you again very, very soon. Bye-bye.